colleagues and members of the public, guests. So I am going to open a public hearing for the purpose of, this is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means meeting on February 14th, 2008. The public hearing is open for the purpose of taking public testimony on items that are on the agenda. We normally, there is a sign-in sheet for members of the public who are here to testify. We ask people to be focused in their testimony and limit their comments to about 2 to 3 minutes so that we can give everyone who wants to speak an opportunity to do that. Colleagues, we also have a very busy agenda, and I'm going to set time limits on each item as we go through so that we can respect people's time and get them to their later commitments this evening.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ms. Lamont. For purposes of our public hearing, I'll first of all ask Gordon Sayer to speak. Is Mr. Sayer in the audience?
I am.
Dr. Sayer?
Thank you, Representative Nolan, and members of the committee. I have brought a copy of my testimony here, and I come to you from U of O and as the president of the U of O Senate. I served on our Senate
Excuse me, you need to identify yourself for the
My name is Gordon Sayer, Professor of English and President of the University Senate. I served along with three colleagues on a subcommittee to examine the financing of the arena project. We began meeting last September. Other members of the committee included Dennis Howard, Knight Professor of Business and a faculty member on the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at our business school, and author of a book, Financing Sport. He has served as a paid consultant and delivered expert testimony on numerous stadium and arena projects. Another member of the committee was John Chalmers, an associate professor of finance in the College of Business, who has published research, provided expert testimony, and worked in the industry of tax-exempt bonds. Our final report was issued on January 8th and endorsed by the full University Senate on the 23rd. This document provides an independent and well-informed analysis of the revenue projections and fiscal risks of the arena plan. I wish to present on behalf of our subcommittee an update on this report and a recommendation to the legislature as it considers the $200 million of bonding authority for the arena. You have likely heard from many constituents about this project, and it has become more timely in the last week since the emergence of another report dated in 2004 called the Eco Northwest Report. I want to point out that our analysis is independent and open and transparent and looks at the fans' willingness to pay, which will be the key factor in paying off the debt for this arena. Our conclusion in our report was that with the optimum revenue structure comprising seat licenses, annual donations to the Duck Athletic Fund, and face value season ticket prices, the arena could reap $7,300,000 in its first year of operation, this including only ticket-related revenues, not concessions or advertising. These calculations are based upon an increase in the average total annual cost per seat from $352 today in Mack Court to $844 in the new arena. This is a large increase. We believe it is very close to the maximum the market will bear. These revenue estimates also require that an additional 2,000 season tickets be sold at higher
Excuse me, Dr. Sayer.
Yes.
A few people in the audience can't hear you. Could you pull that mic a little closer to you, because we'd all like to be able to hear
you. Okay, I'm sorry. Is that better?
That's perfect.
Yes. So the basic revenue and expense figures drawn from the report commissioned by the Athletic Department from Convention Sports and Leisure indicates that gross ticket revenues together with advertising and seat licenses will be $13.9 million per year. Debt service for the 30-year bonds together with pre-existing obligations will come to around $14.6 million once construction is complete. Operating expenses for the new arena will be $3.5 million, according to CSL's estimates. Hence, the arena will be about $4 million a year in the red. Our committee's first recommendation to the U of O administration is for transparency. The U of O faculty, staff, and students through the Senate need to know the arena's construction and operating costs and its ticket-related revenues with timely and complete disclosure. If revenues are less than anticipated, the athletic department needs to absorb this risk by cutting expenses. We also believe that the athletic department would be well advised to engage faculty experts in thinking about the pricing model for the tickets in the new arena. Hence, we emphasize that according to our revenue estimates, the new arena will not be a self-supporting facility and is only by virtue of the monies from the Legacy Fund that this project will enhance the bottom line of the U of O athletic department. Phil and Penny Knight's gift is fundamental to the success of this project, and we are very grateful to them for it. If construction begins this summer on a new arena, it will not be ready for games until the 2010-11 season at the earliest. Thus, 2 years of debt service will have to be paid out of the Legacy Fund. And because net revenue from the arena is likely to be negative even after it opens, the dependence on Mr. Knight's gift will continue. Therefore, it is of the utmost importance to safeguard the Legacy Fund and preserve its principal through a conservative investment strategy. At this moment, I think we can agree the economic outlook is uncertain and the project cannot afford a Legacy Fund to be depleted by market losses. Thus, our committee's second recommendation is for an investment strategy that would keep the principal in safe investments during the first 5 to 10 years of the life of this fund. So to summarize, our subcommittee is prepared to endorse the arena financing plan and urge you to approve the bonding authority for it, provided that 3 key recommendations from our report are implemented. These are, first, full transparency and disclosure of arena costs and revenues during the full 30-year term of the bonds. Second, a prudent investment strategy for Legacy Fund that eliminates risk to the principal. And third, continuing financial self-sufficiency on the part of a U of O athletic department that will assume the risk of this project and manage its programs accordingly. And our full report, running some 30 or 40 pages, is available on the U of O website, or I will be glad to send you a copy. And I've also prepared copies of my letter and testimony today. So thank you very much, Representatives Nolan, Senator Schrader, and members of the committee.
Dr. Sayer, thank you for making the effort to come and give us that testimony. It's very helpful. Emily McLean. And those are the only two people I have signed up for public testimony, so if there is anyone else here who would like to participate, I need to know that before I move into the next part of the agenda by signing up on the side. Ms. McLean.
Representative Nolan, Senator Schrader, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emily McLean. I am the student body president at the University of Oregon. And just to clear things up, I know that sometimes I testify in front of you on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, and I'm not doing that today. I'm here to speak to you as a student of the University of Oregon and as the student body president regarding the topic that Senate President Sayer just spoke about, the arena. I wanted to come before you today because I know you will be discussing bonding, and I know that the subject is going to be going on around the building, and I wanted to weigh in because there hasn't really been a student perspective yet in the building, and so I wanted to give you that understanding and come just to say a couple of things. The first is that I would like to say I'm not here to ask you to oppose the arena yet or to oppose the arena, you know, necessarily, but I am here to say that I think that in such a very big decision like this, that the legislature and all of us involved in this decision should act prudently. And I think that it is important to take into account the potential effects of the bonding for the arena and the potential effects that it will have on the student experience, both academic, residential, and in general, just the student experience and being involved at the University of Oregon. So I wanted to say that first, just that I think that we should act cautiously consciously, and I think that from the student perspective, to give you an understanding, President Frohnmayer was really gracious enough to come to a forum with students along with Mr. Kilkenny about the arena, and it was a really great opportunity to have a dialogue on campus between students and the university administration and to start getting some questions asked and some answers. And at the end of the meeting, we had students that were in a lot of different places. I asked some students to raise their hands if they were just absolutely adamantly opposed to the arena, and there are maybe about five students that raised their hands. Then I asked how many students in the room are just kind of not sure right now and are not satisfied yet with the answers that we've received, and a big majority of the students raised their hand. They just weren't sure, and they felt like they weren't satisfied yet with the knowledge and the information that we had gained about the arena. And then, you know, I asked how many of you guys are supportive, and of course there were 5 to 10 hands that went up. And so, just so you know, a lot of folks, probably like yourselves, still have questions about the outcome of such large bond debt being, you know, put out for the University of Oregon and also for the state of Oregon. And I want to say that on behalf of the students and on behalf of myself as well, just to come before you as a student at the University of Oregon, I want to give a couple examples of the questions that I still have and of some of the discussions that I think should be had about such a really big decision. And I think the first one is that there are a lot of things that the University of Oregon has prioritized when it comes to the student experience and when it comes to being the flagship university of the state of Oregon. And I think one of those is the residential experience, is the opportunity to come, live, and learn all in one place. And we have created, and President Frohnmayer, our administrators, housing directors have been a part of a strategic housing plan. As some of you guys might know, the strategic housing plan would use the exact same type of bonds, F bonds, if we were to pursue bonding for those type of capital construction projects. And so I think that it's a very important conversation for all of us to have. What are the potential effects of such large bonding debt like F bonds for the arena? And, you know, I think that we'll be able to have some of those questions answered later on, but that's one of the things that, you know, right now we're trying to improve the experience at the U of O when it comes to residential life, and we've done a great job. We built a really great building, a living learning center that includes, you know, in together an educational experience and also a really great residential living experience. And there, I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but some of the dorms at the University of Oregon are not ranked very highly in some of those magazines that students read about the U of O. I think Dungeons and Dorms was the title or something. And so just to put it out there that there are students that are really having conversations about how do we make our school a better place and how do we make sure that students are having a good experience here. And residential life is one of those really significant experiences that we're really trying to improve upon. And I think that there's a potential for conflict. And so I'd kind of like us to start asking those questions and to really be cautious and, you know, kind of inquisitive about what the impact of such a large project like the basketball arena will be. The second that I wanted to give as an example is that of the academic experience and just where the priorities are when it comes to students of the state of Oregon. Because I know, like many of you guys might have heard, last year the Oregon University System Working Group did a study that showed in the next decade about 85% of new jobs will require, to get especially the higher wage jobs, will require a college degree. So in a time when it is more important than ever to receive a higher education in the state of Oregon, I just want to start looking at what are our priorities exactly? Where are we putting our focus? And so I think that the arena brings about a really good opportunity for us to have that discussion. And so I just wanted to put that out there on behalf of myself as a student at the University of Oregon with some concerns and still some unanswered questions. And just also know that these conversations are happening at the U of O, and I think that students really should be at the forefront of that discussion, and our education should be at the forefront of that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McLean. Wisdom beyond your years. Thank you. Any other people to testify during the public hearing part of our agenda? Before we close, colleagues, I would certainly like to recognize that President Dave Frommeyer is in the room. We had an opportunity to visit with him last month, with him and his team, and he has not asked to testify, but I would like to personally acknowledge all the effort that he and his staff have put into answering my questions and concerns, and I think many of you have seen, if you haven't yet, you will see, because I just received from him a letter proposing the establishment of a reserve fund to add additional security to make sure that the general fund isn't tapped to support the bonds. It's an important piece for me, and I think it reflects a admirable willingness to continue working on this effort and to address the concerns that have been raised here. That particular bill, for members of the audience, will be actually acted on next week, but while the President was here, I wanted to give him credit for that and tell him that you have moved my position on this arena. Seeing no further witnesses for public testimony, I will close the public hearing on public testimony, and we will move to a work session. I'll open the work session. Colleagues, out of respect for all the people in the audience as well as our colleagues on the dais, I'm going to propose some individual time limits on the agenda items. I think the first two items, the report from the Department of Education and... Okay, I didn't have it. Thank you. We're actually, Robin, Ms. Lamont is reminding me that we are going to adjust the order in order to reflect that we have elected officials who are here for an item. We're going to move the report from the Judicial Department to the top of the item. Work items under the work session, and I would like to reserve no more than a half hour for that discussion. I would also suggest that we limit discussion under the report from the Department of Education when we get to it to about 5 to 10 minutes. I'm just giving you these so that you can be mindful as you construct your comments or questions. The report from the Department of Revenue for about 5 to 10 minutes. State Police, about a half hour, and a discussion on higher ed and community college capital project policies. Those are not individual items. That will be a half hour at the end of our agenda. With that, colleagues, I will move to the item on under House Bill 5100, a report from the Judicial Department on their e-court project. Chief Justice DeMunis, if you and your colleagues, whoever you've brought with you, would approach, and then Ms. Lamont, kick us off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the department has been requested to report on its e-court technology project with a focus on the measurable outcomes and the business needs that create the basis for this technology conversion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Representative Nolan, Senator Schrader, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. I'm Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court and the Administrative Head of the Judicial Branch of Government. With me today are Multnomah County Circuit Judge Michael Marcus and Multnomah County Trial Court Administrator Douglas Bray. I ask Judge Marcus and Douglas Bray to begin the presentation on behalf of the judicial branch because I believe this committee will derive the most benefit if our presentation is focused through the lens of a judge and a trial court administrator who have been integrally involved in a five-year planning process, who work in the busiest courthouse in Oregon, and on a daily basis work with the shortcomings inherent in a 25-year-old case registry system. Also here are State Court Administrator Kingsley Click, Sarah Gates, Director of the Financial Administrative Services Division, Bud Borgia, our CIO, and Steve Davis from MTG, depending on the questions that are asked during this, they may have some comments to follow up in answer to your questions or some additional points. Finally, I'd like to thank the Legislative Fiscal Office for their dedication and for their hard work on our eCourt initiative. I'll now turn the presentation over to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Michael Marcus. I'm a circuit judge in Multnomah County. I took the bench in 1990. One of my first assignments was in a high-volume court to give release decisions and arraignments. And I followed what I understood to be the process and the culture, and I made decisions. And a day or two later, I read the newspaper to read that one of the people I had chosen to release had brutalized members of a family that ran a mom-and-pop small business. And, of course, I was horrified that I had allowed such a thing to happen. And that began my education into what a case-based system is opposed to a person-based system. A case-based system like OGIN is one that collects information about a case. If somebody's involved in another case, is charged with a new crime, if they misspell their name on purpose, or the officer gets it wrong, or they use a different date of birth or a different identification, or borrow somebody else's ID, they're not connected in any way in our database. The reason that I made a bad decision was, in tremendous part, that I don't have reliable access to all the information that swells up in our system around us without us knowing it's there, about what other charges are pending, what other history we've had about this individual, what wants and warrants are connected to this person, and I learned from the newspaper article what I should have known before I made the release decision. In 1997, this legislature passed House Bill 2229, which directed all of the criminal justice agencies, including courts, law enforcement, corrections, juvenile and adult, to collect, share, and manage data so as to allow us to link records, track offenders, and learn which of our responses to all of the folks that we dealt with worked best in terms of reducing criminal behavior. Nothing much happened other than the law said what we should be doing. The public safety plan adopted by the Criminal Justice Commission in 2001 came up with its first recommendation, which was Oregon should develop availability of offender-based data in order to track an offender through the criminal justice system and to facilitate data-driven pretrial release, sentencing, and correctional supervision decisions. That was the first recommendation of the Criminal Justice Commission in 2001. The court has created a 2020 vision as part of our regular planning process. One of the pieces of that under partnerships is together we promote public safety and quality of life, improve the lives of children and families, and protect people who cannot protect themselves. We use preventive measures and effective sentencing to reduce criminal behavior. On the right side of the same page, employ technology to improve sentencing practices and data sharing systems. Our case-based OGIN system is as useless in collecting and displaying data that we should see as it was when I took the bench in 1990. All of these advances in what we should be doing, recognition of how we should be focused on our impact on families, children, and the safety of the community, have not improved one iota the progress of OGIN as a resource. Although it contains all the information we need to know all the things that have happened to people in our family courts, in our juvenile courts, in our criminal courts, we don't have access to that information because it's a case-based system and we don't have the modern technology to collect and display the information. What's urgent about this is we're still making release decisions without full access to information. Full access to information about what risks, cases, prosecutions, and behaviors we already should know are associated with this person. So we're going to release people who will do harm that we wouldn't release if we had that information. Equally, we don't have collected visions of the data that surrounds us that we've already collected to see which dispositions for which offenders under which circumstances brought them back without a failure to appear and without a new crime. Those are two kinds of ways of using data, and it's our vision and it's part of our plan in collecting and sharing data, making it person-based, to give judges and all of those who interact with the system this kind of information. The same thing is true of release decisions as is true of sentencing decisions, probation violation decisions, delinquency and dependency cases. We don't know whether somebody has a case for a sex abuse conviction.
when we're dealing with the same person in a family law situation or a dependency or a delinquency violation, to determine whether they should be placed with that person who, by the way, with a different date of birth in our same OJU system, may have some very concerning convictions and backgrounds that we should know about, but we don't get to look at. The same is true with custody disputes, where we're making decisions about which parent should get the child. Wouldn't it be nice to know if that parent under a different name or a different date of birth, or we just didn't have the connection and the software to show it to us, was convicted of a series of domestic violence cases or assault cases or theft cases? There are all sorts of pieces of information that lurk in our database that we're not using now. Every day that we proceed without this kind of access to information, will be making decisions that harm Oregon citizens, families, and children. They can ruin not just a business, not just a couple of days or a week. They can ruin lifetimes if we make decisions that more information would have prevented or changed with the placement of children. We cannot share data with law enforcement and corrections so that when we issue a family abuse protective order, it may take a long time and be unreliable before that gets into the hands and on the computers of the law enforcement people we depend upon to enforce it in time to prevent the assault or the homicide. The urgency to all this is that we are allowing harm to happen because we have an archaic system that prevents us from accessing information we all should have when we make those decisions, and it prevents us from seeing what's worked under which circumstances, under offenders, family placements, custody decisions, visitation decisions. That's the urgency to this. It's been going on for years, and every time we delay it, there are more people hurt by the mistakes that I've listed. I'm happy to answer any questions. Doug Gray has the administrator's view of what's
going on. Thank
you.
Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, Coach Schrader, and members of the committee and staff. For the record, I'm Doug Gray. I'm the trial court administrator in the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon for Multnomah County. Today we celebrate the birthday of this great state. And one of the curious things about this birthday is that if you were a clerk of the court in 1859 and you came into a courthouse today in our circuit court system, you would find that we are using exactly the same kind of paper-based techniques to maintain all the court files of information. Nothing has changed in that regard in over 200 years. We rely on paper. We rely on people to walk it in the door, to mail it to us. We handle each document. We safeguard it, and we spend a lot of resources to do so. The volume of documents just in Multnomah County alone is enormous. We have over 4 million case files in our archives. That's increasing at about 200,000 files a year. Each year we have around 35,000 cases active at any one time. And each day we get about an 8-foot high stack of paper that is walked into the courthouse, mailed to us, or generated by orders of judges in acting on matters. All of that documentation has to be handled on a document-by-document basis through the rest of the history of that case. And it's incredibly labor-intensive. Access to documents hasn't changed much either since 1859. You may come to the courthouse in a Prius now and not ride the energy-efficient horse, but you still have to come to the courthouse to see a document. Or you have to write to us and wait the weeks it takes to respond. There is not an efficient way for the business community, for law enforcement, or for the public to access documents that would be perfectly adequate to have a broader base of access through current technology. Our case management system, as Judge Marcus has pointed out, is very antiquated. It represents the best of the 1970s decade when the programming and the database structure on which it was built were state-of-the-art. I love the 70s, but I'm glad they're gone. I'd like to have the case management system gone as well. We need to upgrade our case management system. the biennial expense of working with paper-based documents and a case management system that is incapable of sharing information or having information displayed on the web is enormous. In Multnomah County, we have 34 staff that do nothing but put papers in files and safeguard files. We have 40 staff who answer the phones to tell people who call in what information is in our case management system about their case. It makes no sense in today's environment when almost anyone can go to the web and find out any piece of information that they need to know. Just for the paper and the staffing, just for maintaining the paper in Multnomah County, we spend about $4 million a year for those staff. Statewide, we think that number is about $15 million a year. Just in maintaining paper, receiving paper over the counters, and allowing people to have information that's in a computer system on a case base but cannot be shared really efficiently with the public. That investment would be better used on the kinds of issues that Judge Marcus has raised, on expanding the circuit court services to the public safety community, to the safety and welfare of children and families, and to the business community. There's enormous pent-up demand for access to the documents we have and to the information we have in our case management system. I want to take just a second to talk to you about what is included in the Chief Justice's eCourt proposal. First of all, it provides for a web-based access to information, and it is foremost to put information that we have, that people need for their business, for their personal lives, for their professional duties, into a system where they have access to it 24 hours a day. Secondly, it allows parties to electronically file information with the court. There would no longer be a need to come to the courthouse to file documents, to pay filing fees, and will allow people to obtain basic court services such as paying financial obligations over the internet. Very simple stuff that we do every day with in the commercial world, and we would like to begin to provide some of those resources to the people we serve and the people of the state of Oregon. The eCourt is designed to be phased in, and the purpose of our appearance today is to request funding for phase one and two. The plan for phase one and two does not involve a general fund expenditure. It does involve authorization for debt, and that's what we're requesting. But it gets us started. And eventually, sometime, we have to start on this journey. I realize that the economic cycle is not advantageous for the issue of debt at this point. But in terms of an investment to make, in terms of the value it gives, I think it's a great investment to make. And I hope that you do too. There's been a lot of planning put into this. The courts and the judges are ready for it, and we would really ask that it not be put off to the next biennium consideration for the budget. That's all I have. If there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I will bring to your attention the report that Ms. Lamont has done on this project, which is very thorough and well worth your careful study. This decision will not be made today, but I think while we have the experts here in the room, I want people to have access to them for answering questions. But be sure you read that report because it really addresses and answers a lot of the questions. And I've got about 15 minutes for this discussion. Representative Jensen.
I'll be very quick, Madam Co-Chair. It just sounds to me like the gentleman were talking about the Oregon State Legislature, not the court system.
Stuck in the 70s, is that what you're saying? Any other questions, comments?
Right,
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Judge Marcus, you've done some amazing work on trying to make sentencing more effective and to increase public safety through proper sentencing. That's what I'm interested in, how this might affect public safety. Could you explain a little bit more about how you see that working?
Co-Chairs, Representative Shields, the part of this is just giving the information that anybody knows how to use. You treat somebody differently on an assault four if they've got three prior assaults than if it's their first. The more you know about them, obviously there are choices that you make differently. What the piece that this adds is being able to see the general picture of how we have responded in a variety of ways that we have tried to the various slices of offenders that we see under different circumstances. And we have a pilot essentially running in Multnomah County, which is a glimpse of how useful this can be. You can actually see right up there on the bench in seconds how someone like the offender who has a similar criminal history and has other similarities with this person, how that group of people has responded in terms of recidivism to all the things that we've done to those sorts of people. So you can make an evidence-based decision. And that's the real power, half of the power here, is being able to equip decision makers across the whole spectrum of criminal justice, across all of those delinquency, dependency, visitation, and family law decisions, the release decisions, the probation violations, with real evidence of what's happened, what's worked best, and what hasn't worked, and the things we've done in the past. It doesn't tell you what to do, but it gives you information you need to have to make an informed decision and to have the participants tell you something useful about it. We are filling our prisons, our programs, our probation officer caseloads based without this information on which of the offenders actually are highest risk, which of the offenders are most likely to be lower risk after they go there. This is the technology that we, I think, have an obligation to make available to serve the public safety, community values, the quality of life and family realities in Portland, because we affect them all the time, whether we try to or not. Every decision we make has an outcome. We need to be able to look at those outcomes to make better decisions.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I just checked that these would be COPs, but the payment on the COPs would actually be general fund in the next year. That's something we have to consider. Mm-hmm. Another question I think I have is, you know, we've got the Owen project, we've got several other technology projects that are here. Is there any way any of these things can be meshed together to help each other out?
Senator and members of the committee, one of the companion pieces to this is that there's going to be a request to the executive branch to convene a public safety work group to deal with data standards and to develop a data warehouse so that as the judicial department moves forward, the partners within the public safety system will be making sure that they have the same standards so that the data can be accessed readily and transmitted readily. It is a different environment than the old mainframe type of environment, but there's still need for system compatibility.
Follow-up, Senator?
Are we developing public-private partnerships? Are the industry being involved with this thing? Is providing some of the information or software or whatever they provide?
Senator and members of the committee, what the Judicial Department is doing with much of the business plan is to adopt and use the standards that have already been implemented by the executive branch, for example, for its payment systems, for its data access systems, the kind of thing that's being used by, for example, DCDS for people who make online license payments, so that the state itself will have a uniform standard.
Okay, just on e-government, don't we have an e-government program? Is that kind of what you're talking
exactly
about?
That's exactly what I was
going to
say.
Thank you.
Exactly, good. Thank you. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and welcome. It appears that in the eight states and or counties that have already begun implementing some form of e-court, they're experiencing, we'll call it cost avoidance, reduced staff, reduced development costs. Would you speak to the cost avoidance feature of the proposal?
Co-chairs and Senator Gordley, I will start on this, and Mr. Steve Davis from MTG has joined us at the as I pointed out, the paper-based system and the requirement to have people actually answer the phone to tell people what's in our computer system those are positions that will not be needed for those functions. After we install the web-based access, the e-filing system, we have all of our content in an enterprise content management system, which means all documents are maintained in electronic form only. We have a new case management system, which has web-based availability so that people can answer their own questions, can find out how much money they owe, and can pay online. And we have a decision support system that supports the kinds of things that Judge Marcus has been talking about. There will be a tremendous opportunity to shift staff to other kinds of programs and resources over the life of implementing this system. So we don't know exactly how it will play out, but there will be reduced demands for additional staffing due to increased workload, because the technology will replace the terribly staff-intensive things we're doing. Staff will be available to work in treatment courts, to work in special programs that are important for self-help facilities and for those kinds of services, and it will not be necessary to come back as often to ask for resources for those programs. So what we would see is a reorientation of how we're using staff as we move out of that paper-based and COBOL-based environment.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Actually, Senator Gordley asked my question, so I'll
Thanks.
Pass.
Great. Thanks. Yes. Senator Carter.
Mine actually is more of a statement. I went to this past Friday, I went to support a constituent of mine at the court. The appointment was for 8:30. We arrived at 7:30, three blocks around the courthouse. Finally got up to the door inside. It was very, very cold, may I add. And it took us another 20 minutes to get through the line and get things done. If I can tell this committee anything in terms of what is going to save citizens of the state opportunity when you look at this piece, this e-court piece that they're talking about, will that judge help deal with some of those long lines in the cold weather and the rain that I had to endure, which was an hour and something that we still are trying to get into the courthouse?
Co-Chair Senator Carter, one of the great advantages is that so many of those people who come to court to access documents to pay their traffic fines and so forth don't have to come to court in e-court. They pay just like a lot of us do online when we pay our checks or buy things online. So people will be able to look at documents. They don't have to come into the courthouse. They don't have to wait in line to get a copy of the file. They don't have to wait until somebody else is through with the file. People from all over the state, all over the city, can look at the same document because it's electronic, just so we can all access a web page, no matter how many people are looking at it. So the number of people who will actually have to come through the courthouse will be greatly reduced to those who absolutely must be present. So, yes, that's certainly that's one of the side benefits.
Thank you. Co-Chair Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As you would talking about this for some time, and I really appreciate the hard work the judicial branch has done, the Chief Justice in particular, in making the case here. This is ultimately a $100 million project, so Senator Nelson's questions are apropos, and I'd like to think that they've been pretty well addressed, actually, between LFO's work and the Chief Justice's work to a large degree. I would direct members to the back of our packet that we have here, and you'll see some outcomes. We're all of a sudden starting to generate some interest in this, and Chief Justice, I really do appreciate you, sir, for including measurable outcomes. When they look at the back few pages, 7, 9, whatever, they get into what we're going to hopefully see. And I think that's really powerful. And it gets to our discussion last night when mental health communities talk about how they're going to solve all these problems. Well, I'm not a mental health expert. I'm not a judge, and I'm not a court administrator. I have no idea how to make your job more efficient, more successful. But what I can do, if you give me parameters about what you think you're going to improve and how much you're going to improve over a period of time, we can track that and ask intelligent questions as legislators, citizen legislators. So this is exactly the type of information we need. And then if you look at the little farther in the middle of the packet, when they compare the other states, you know, King County, Washington, reduced staff 19 positions, annual savings $250,000 for microphone. These are things you can hang your hat on and go to the restaffing in the judicial branch and use the limited resources we give you in the first place much more efficiently. For me, and I'm not big on bonding projects. We bonded a lot this last triennium. I have some concerns, but I think this is worth moving forward. I think we're safeguarded a little bit because of the rollout strategy that the court has decided to pursue. So if for some inexplicable reason this thing doesn't, you know, come about the way it's supposed to, we're on the hook for a limited amount of money as opposed to $100 million out of the chute. I think it's very smart. That shows we are prudent, apropos some of the earlier discussion, public testimony. The last piece I guess I would like to see, and what we're hopefully going to do in our bonding bill in another week or so, is to provide an opportunity for a bonding limitation, a certain amount of ultimately debt service to be acquired. But I think the courts at our next e-board hopefully will come forward and make that, you know, the final business case that they're ready to go. I would think there are two things we need to see. One in particular would be maybe a little more quantification of those outcomes, how it rolls out over time, so we can benchmark how you're hitting your benchmarks. And, you know, that's not a big thing. They've done a good job here. The other thing that intrigues me, and I'm sorry to talk so long, but the thing that really turns me on, if you will, about this whole project is the tangential benefit of the database. We argue, and we have big problems over how does the Oregon State Police relate to the DAs, relate to the judicial branch, relate to mental health. You know, Judge Marcus made a good point about, you know, you don't have all the information in front of you when you're making a judicial decision or picking someone up by the side of the road. The key piece that I would ask the court, especially under the august power and privilege of the Supreme Court Justice, to say, let's convene, and they already have, they've had some meetings with the legal community, about let's make this the database that we're all going to use, or at least the clearinghouse. And to me, this would be a huge plus. Then in the future, we have a common set of computer characters that can characterize the data and the individuals, be protected and secure. And then when the state police come forward with their request for a new LEDS project, or whatever, we'll have a common understanding. To me, this is probably the most important, one of the most important pieces of this whole project. And I think we have the opportunity, I know, in talking to the Chief Justice and contacting my own DAs and some of the other agencies around the state to deal with law enforcement, that this would be a great opportunity, and maybe between now and 2009 we could get this worked out if the Chief Justice and others are willing to continue that advisory group you have going. I think that is something that's very, very powerful. I'd like to have the same thing done on the education side, but I think this is very, very powerful and something we should consider. So I'm a supporter, Madam Co-Chair.
It sounds like it.
Is that a yes?
Gentlemen, and Justice DeNunes, thank you for your time and your work on this. We will be looking at this specifically next week in our capital construction bill and the bond bill. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Let's quickly pick up the Department of Education item on here, report on the status of the consolidation of the two campuses. DOD.
Coming in the door.
Oh, okay. DOD, DOE. We surprised you, Ms. McGlashan. Sorry. Thanks. We'll start with Sue then. And I don't know if you heard me say that this is a 5 to 10 minute max item, please, because we had the benefit of hearing much of this report last month, and we asked the department to remind the committee to come back just with a few specific pieces of information that were not available last month. So this is really just a refresher on the report we got last month. Ms. McGlashan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. For the record, I'm Sue McGlashan with the Oregon Department of Education, and I am here at your request with some follow-up information regarding the issue of co-location of the Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf on the School for the Deaf campus. And by now you should have received a packet of information on the work done as of last week on the issue of co-locating the two schools. And I know your agenda is full today, but I'd like to briefly summarize what was in the packet to provide some context to you. And the department was directed through a 2005 budget note to study, as you know, the cost effectiveness of transferring the OSB program to the OSD campus. And a committee of stakeholders, including a couple of legislative members, was formed in response to this budget note. And this committee looked at the two programs and their budgets and staffing and operations and developed some recommendations, one of which was to move OSB to the OSD campus, provided the cost of the move didn't override the current cost of the programs and subsequent savings were retained within programs for students with sensory impairments. And that and other recommendations are in this April 2006 report in your packet. Next, I'd like to refer you to the March 2007 State School Study, and that's the cost-benefit analysis that was produced by ODE in response to the 05 budget note. And that report incorporates cost estimates independently established by OTAC, as well as the appraisal done at the OSD campus. And we mentioned those cost estimates of $13 to $16 million from OTAC and the $9 million appraisal when we appeared last week. And then last session in 07, we were directed to continue looking into the viability of co-location and to develop an RFP for the cost to remodel and renovate the existing structures at OSD to accommodate the OSB students. So we reported to you, as you know, last week that we had been focusing on the portion of the budget note related to developing the RFP for your review. And you heard last week that we engaged Innovation Partnership and their expertise in school construction to help guide us to that goal. We reported to you that they were recommending we basically engage a developer to lead and manage the consolidation process, and that report is also in your packet. And last week you had concerns and questions about increasing construction costs over time, whether we had engaged the Department of Administrative Services to help us, appropriate program design and stakeholder input, and the timing and cost of this project. And we just want to go on the record that we have some of these same concerns and questions, and some of those questions we just simply don't have the answers to right now. But more specifically, Senator Schrader had questions about when will you see the numbers and when can we get the project done. So you've been provided a handout and back. I just want to draw your attention that it is 2 pages. And in the last week, we met with DAS facilities and some of their planning and construction folks to get their input. And what we've been able to come up with, thanks to them, is a possible timeline for this project. And I do need to point out that this is a very rough estimate and could be considered aggressive. But what I'd like to draw your attention to is that the timeline based on the DAS input is on the left-hand side on page 1. The estimated timeline that we presented to you last week, or Innovation Partnership presented to you last week, is on the right-hand side. You can see that those timelines are not that unlike each other. I draw your attention to the first phase of the DAS timeline. That is significantly shortened from Innovation Partnerships because under the DAS scenario, they basically are the development or the developer, and the development team is already in place. It would be DAS, it would be ODE, and it would be an architectural and engineering firm that is currently under contract with DAS. But if you look at the bottom line, you'll see that for the total duration of the project, they're pretty similar, pretty close, 2.5 to 3.5 years. So I also want to point out that there are some upfront costs associated with our continuing. If you turn this handout over on page 2 under notes, you'll see that DAF is estimating that for phases 1 and 2, there are costs of $200,000 to $300,000 associated with those phases. And basically what we get for that is a feasibility study. And that feasibility study would provide a range of options, probably 3 to 5, that could then be presented to stakeholders. Once an option is selected, we would go into the design phase. And then please note, too, the third bullet on page 2 under the notes indicates the DAS is saying the timeline for phases 3 through 5, and that would be stakeholder input, design, and construction, could change drastically depending upon the feasibility study. So pretty much from here on out, whether it's partnering with DAS or going through a developer selection process such as that suggested by Innovation Partnership, there's some costs associated with continuing, and these weren't anticipated in the department's legislatively adopted budget. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hill, do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, at this point in time, I don't. The LFO recommendation is to have the committee acknowledge receipt of the report, yet we would advise you to instruct them to come back to either the emergency board or another joint Ways and Means Committee to update with further information. A number of things that were in the budget report weren't necessarily met.
Is there a proper time frame, Madam Chair, that the department and LFO think would be appropriate to report? Meaningful, get us meaningful information.
Madam Chair and Senator Schrader, I didn't completely hear all.
Sure. If we're going to come back and report on progress, is there an appropriate time frame where we might expect substantial progress to be able to evaluate what's going on?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Schrader, actually, it was your LFO analyst comments that I really didn't hear, and I thought he said something about not being addressed as part of the budget note in it. Well, I would just get clarification on that.
Sure. The point was is that the budget note itself said you were supposed to come with a draft RFP to this committee. That has not been done. You have stated your reasons for not doing so. The question is, though, would you, if the emergency board came back in June, would you be able to have more substantial documents to support?
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, I don't believe we would make much more progress at this point without some funding for the feasibility study. I think we've gone pretty much as far as we can go within our resources, and we've come to a point where, in order to continue, we would need the funding for the feasibility study. I think, again, for us to develop an RFP for the cost of renovating the OSD campus is premature. We don't have the expertise in-house to do that. Innovation Partnerships has recommended that we engage a developer-led team. DAS is saying, basically, that's a great idea. DAS Facilities concurs. So we would be very hesitant to just go forward with an RFP without taking the advice of what we believe to be two sources of expertise.
Any other questions from committee members?
Senator
Carter.
I just would like to say I think that makes all the sense in the world, because it doesn't make sense that we'll come back in June if they've gotten no further than collaboration, and if they have not physically started doing something or at the point at which they're doing it, it doesn't make sense for them to come back in June.
Senator Carter.
Well, just clarification, please, Madam Chair. Are we determining whether the RFP should go out before the feasibility study or vice versa?
That's an excellent question, Senator. I think the message I heard from the department is that they do not feel that they have adequate resources to go further than they are now, which means they don't have a feasibility study, which would be necessary to do an RFP for actual remodeling or construction. So I think we're in a little bit of a quagmire here.
That's sort of news to me, Ms. McGlashan. I'm not. Why do we have this dilemma? I guess is a question I might ask.
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, as I stated last week and now, We don't have the expertise, we feel, within the department to put together an RFP for a construction project. And in talking with Innovation Partnerships, who has put together this site panel of experts who have a lot of experience with siting and building school buildings, in talking with DAS facilities and their construction, planning and construction folks, we're more convinced than ever that, you know, we don't have that expertise, and it would be really a waste of time and staff resources, and I think we'd probably come forward with something that you really wouldn't be happy with.
So what, if I may, Madam Chair, so what this timeline you lay there for us, where did that come from? That sounds like somebody's done some work about over what period, you know, someone has some idea or gave you some information about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. So you want someone else to come in and tell you if this is correct? Is that what I'm gathering?
Madam Chair and Senator Schrader, are you referring to the timeline that was distributed
right
today?
Yes, ma'am.
Again, we met with DAS facilities, and we asked them, if we were to go forward with this, what would you suggest, and what could you give us as a timeline? That's on the left side of the handout. And they're the ones who said, you know, do this feasibility study. Innovation Partnership had a slightly different approach. You know, go out with this RFI, or what they were calling the RFQ, find a developer who can lead a team, which presumably would involve in the planning process something similar to, if not, you know, a feasibility study. Both groups of experts have told us, you know, this is the approach you need to take, and those are where those timelines are coming from.
Ms. McGrashan, since you've said that you can't go further without additional funding, if no funding is available, and in the current environment, I think that's a likely assumption you should make, what happens with this project?
Madam Chair, I think we come up against a brick wall. I don't think we can go any further.
I think, Madam Co-Chair, if I may make a suggestion,
yes,
in the interest of time and
yes,
this new development, perhaps we just acknowledge receipt of the report. We'll have our staff talk to their staff, and we'll move forward at some future date.
I think that's about what we have available. Yes.
So
is that a motion?
Yes, ma'am. I move acknowledge receipt of the report.
Moves that we acknowledge receiving this report. Any discussion? Any objections? Thank you. Okay. Another hopefully quick item for our agenda on Senate Bill 5556, Budget Reconciliation, Department of Revenue. Funding for the administration and enforcement of cigarette and other tobacco products tax laws.
A tobacco man.
Hello, Mr. Whalen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll briefly introduce this, if you, with your permission.
Please.
The department has requested $555,000 of additional cigarette and other tobacco tax appropriations. It would be offset in large part by $400,000 of general fund, which we would reduce their existing budget by. And the reason for the request is twofold. $155,000 of the request is for increased attorney general's fees that they didn't anticipate when we put together the appropriation for the tobacco and cigarette, other tobacco, tobacco and cigarette tax compliance efforts and administration. They're incurring more cost. We've consulted with the Department of Justice. It is exceeding what was in their existing budget. The other cause for the increase is that after refining their internal cost allocation processes, they have found that the administrative cost internally to this program exceed that which was budgeted, and so internal administrative costs that are currently generally funded or general funded in the budget should be funded with these taxes instead. And that's the sum of the request. It's actually an increase over the existing budget of $155,000 and a shift of $400,000 from general fund to other fund.
If anyone asks me to explain what he just said. Ms. Harchenko.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. Mr. Ryan has accurately characterized what we're asking. He did recommend that we reduce the Attorney General fees to $129,000, I believe, to get us at least to the beginning of the regular session and to see if we could manage without the full request, and we're very comfortable with that. But what has happened, just to put it briefly, over the years we have moved the cost of administration, and this is not the law enforcement piece. This is stamp sales, processing returns, processing and accounting for payments, and basic administration of any tax program that we do for the tobacco programs. That those were included under one very large other funds limitation item in our budget. This past legislative session, we were given a special purpose appropriation from the revenues from the cigarette tax and other tobacco products tax. And as we were trying to put all the information together, we didn't adequately recognize the amount of infrastructure within the organization that that we were continuing to provide for purposes of basic administration of the tax programs. And so that was sort of still in the general fund side, and what we want to do is swap out the dollars, basically give you back $400,000 of general fund, have you approve us spending $400,000 of the tobacco revenues to fund administration of the program. And then the net increase is $129,000 for the additional costs of legal services that we're incurring because we are trying to manage our, particularly the licensing of wholesalers and distributors, more carefully than we've been doing in the past.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Discussion?
Question?
Senator Schrader.
I assume that even with the increased overhead and costs, this program is still cost-effective and making us money.
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, the program brings in about $500 million in a biennium, and our administrative cost is running right around 1%, which is consistent with our administrative cost on income tax programs.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Well, the net exchange here, $400,000. So the $400,000 is going to be coming out of tobacco revenues. That's going to affect other programs, I assume. That's just not going in somebody's sock somewhere. So where is the hit going to be in the other state budgets for the $400,000? I mean, you're backing out general fund money, but you're picking up more tobacco tax money with regard to other programs. So where's the hit? Where's that other $400,000 going to be made up?
Chair, members of the committee, that would be from the overall distribution out of cigarette and other tobacco tax receipts. Their administrative costs, they have to keep track of the differences, with how much is for cigarette taxes, how much is other, and each of those tax receipt streams have different distribution formula. I mean, cigarettes go to the health plan, general fund, certain to cities and counties, and the like. So there's a combination of other, quote, hits, if you will. I would like to make the point that lacking these activities, we could see these activities actually help keep the income stream there through the compliance activities as well as in the enforcement and judgments.
What I'm trying to get to is, are we heavily impacting any other program by doing this? My real question. With a 400,000 drop in OHP with matched money is $1 million, but if it's spread across many budgets, so it's not going to be burdensome for any budget, I don't see a problem. I just want to make sure we're not having some unintended consequences here. We have to do this, understand that, but we should be aware of what we might be doing in the budgets.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, it's not a one-on-one to any one program. It's spread through a number of different programs.
I always ask that LFO be aware if there's any particular hit that we are not seeing, let us know.
And rest assured, we have communicated with this issue with our other LFO analysts.
Okay. Thanks. And what's the LFO recommendation?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the LFO recommendation is to increase the appropriation of the cigarette and other tobacco taxes by $529,000, not $555,000, and a reduction in the general fund budget of $400,000.
So the recommendation is that we incorporate that change in Senate Bill 5556, which we'll hear next week.
Can you make that motion, Madam Chair?
Senator Schrader moves the LFO recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion?
Are there any objections? So ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. I appreciate the focused discussion. We'll go back to House Bill 5100, Bonding Authority, for discussion on Department of State Police, Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, OWIN. And I'd propose about a half-hour discussion for this item, members. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, I think what would probably work the best is to have Mr. Ball, the OWIN project manager, at the table. But in your packet, there should be a memo, and I think it'd be best if we walk through some of the key points of the discussion that the work group on OWIN has had over the past three meetings. Mr. Ball is available for questions, and then I'm sure there will be some committee discussion. I just want to recognize the work group members of Senator Berger, Senator Nelson, Senator Schrader, Representative Nathanson, Representative Smith, and Representative Riley, who is out in the audience. They have spent some time looking at this over the past couple of weeks, three meetings, and the stuff that I will go over here today is basically the topics that they discussed over the past three meetings. So I'm going to go to the memo that should be in your packet and talk about some of the background and then also the proposal that that we are recommending at this time. The work group discussed a number of the issues. First of all was the fact that, or the assumption that if no action is taken during this February 2008 session, that basically to include something in the bonding bill that no progress in terms of construction on the OWIN project really can't take place until the summer of 2009, given that only the full legislature has the ability to amend the bonding bill and authorize bonds. That doesn't mean that there isn't further legislative review. In fact, you need expenditure authority, of which the E-Board has power to provide, but the E-Board does not have the authority to authorize bonding. And I think Mr. Ball would agree with this next statement, that there is insufficient information at this time for the legislature to make any final decision to go ahead with construction on any phase of the project, and that he and his project staff would need to come back to the emergency board or other legislative body to get that authority when they are able to convince the legislative emergency board or other body that they are ready to go. I think that local officials play a key part in this project, and what they have indicated in a number of cases is they need some direction and certainty that the OWIN project is going to proceed before they enter into partnerships. The partnerships are important here because many of the local communities and even the federal government in some cases are also having to redo some of their wireless systems, and any partnerships in terms of tower construction or improvements, sharing of microwave systems, or even sharing of a radio system can really lower the cost for state and the other partners that may occur on that. So there is significant potential for partnerships to share in those costs as well as to coordinate emergency communications. The work group discussed a number of issues around partnerships. Probably one of the more important ones, that under any partnership agreement, local government must pay their fair share. There isn't any definition of fair share. And in many cases, the partnerships are really a one-to-one, case-by-case partnership, whether it might be on a set of towers in a county or maybe even a single tower or system. There's a need for a clearinghouse of information. I think OWIN can probably play a role in that in terms of gathering information of what partnerships are available or what plans that local governments are making in terms of systems improvements that they might be making. But again, it needs to be recognized that OWIN can't be making phone calls and doing surveys. It's local governments that need to come forward and tell OWIN of that, of the partnership opportunities. Much of that has occurred, and quite recently, in fact. In some cases, local governments have come forward when there has been expressed interest in the OWIN project. Another area of partnership is the local government's ability to take part or take advantage of some of the state's purchasing power around radio systems, radio equipment. I think that current contract and procurement rules of the state do allow for some of this, and our staff, as well as the OLM staff, will likely take a look at this over the next few months to make sure what needs to be in place is workable. Some of the partnerships are time sensitive. In fact, one of them that came up in the past few weeks in the Southwest counties, they have some federal money, and that money it will not be available unless they spend it over the next approximately 18 months. So there is some need to move ahead if that partnership opportunity and those federal funds are going to be used. The legislature needs to provide some direction to the project team. The work group discussed a path for them. I'm on page 3 of the memo at the top. That path under discussion was that the OLM project proceed with a digital wireless system, which relies on a microwave system as the primary, what is called the hallback or backbone, mainly to communicate between towers and back to dispatch centers, and that fiber should be looked at as an alternative or to that in cases where it makes sense both economically and reliability. Public safety wireless systems work on sort of what is called a five nines on reliability, 99.999% reliability. In many cases, fiber and other technologies do not meet that criteria at this time. It doesn't say they can't. And in some cases, even in the state systems and local systems, fiber is used for some functions. It is thought that the ODOT and state police should be the priorities right now for any state investment into wireless communications. The Department of Forestry has invested over the past few years in a system to take care of some of the issues, but they would probably likely still come onto the state system at some time in the future. Planning for a trunk system, I don't want to get into the technology. If people have questions, I think the experts are in the room for that. But if we move forward with the trunk system, probably should plan for that, but wait for the decision on that. The project should be rolled out on a regional basis as opportunities present themselves, both for project sound management and to take part of take advantage of partnerships as they come up. And in terms of rolling out the project, that the microwave system or the backbone system and the upgrading of tower sites probably should take priority, and then as the project rolls out further, the radio systems and other things that are part of the system become part of the financing. Where the money is spent on. The project development really needs to take an evaluation of the marginal cost of adding more coverage area, which is a benefit. Currently, the wireless systems of state government, roughly 80% coverage across the state. At one time, the goal was to go to 95% coverage, but as you get closer to that 95%, the marginal cost of that increase becomes significant. And I think it is important for the project as well as the legislature to take a look at that marginal cost as time goes on, as a project is presented to them and rolled out. And finally, whatever the rollout schedule is, the project needs to take a look at if there are some really critical needs in all parts of the state that need to be taken care of, whether a tower or something else is about ready to fall over and should be replaced. It likely should be replaced. One thing that LFO strongly feels about is that there needs to be an ongoing independent quality assurance component or contractor, and if this is approved to go in a bonding bill and the project comes back, let's say in the June e-board or a summer e-board, that needs to be a component of it. And finally, there was some discussion around governance. At this time, LFO believes that the existing State Interoperability Executive Council, or what is referred to often as the SEIC, could provide whatever governance to need in the short term. It has local government representation as well as state agencies. If anything, and one member of the work group had a want for that, thank you, is that maybe some business people without any connection to the wireless or communications industry could add some benefit to that council. We need to take a look at the statutory appointment authority for that council before that might happen. Long-term governance issues are probably statutory changes. The proposal that's on the table for discussion What the work group also discussed was to include a total of $76 million in the bonding bill for this session. Those are the initial stages of the project. That does not mean that the project has the authority to go out and have the bonds issued and start construction. That only provides the authority that must be taken. If it's going to happen during this biennium, they would need to come back to the emergency board or some other legislative body that has the authority to increase expenditure limitation before they move forward. And DAS is, the debt people at DAS have also said that, that once that expenditure authority would be granted, that would be their go-ahead to go ahead and issue the bonds as this project rolls out. Given the lack of available general fund resources, it is unclear whether debt service costs, the funds for debt service costs in 07-09, but those debt service costs could be capitalized, meaning that there would be a little extra debt service or a little extra bonds issued to pay for the debt service cost interest payments for this current biennium. That is nothing new. It's been done in regular basis on state buildings, and in the past couple of years it's been done for prison construction, I believe in the 2005 session. On number three there you see the estimated debt financing if the full $76 million would be issued. The amount of debt financing estimate here was based on development of the backbone and tower improvements in three areas, Southwest counties, the Northwest counties, and then a Bend to Medford loop. Any progress or any rollout of any of those projects would have to depend on partnership opportunities and, if possible, the potential for federal funds. And finally, at the bottom of page four, as I've said before, they would be expected to come back to the emergency board. In fact, they'd be required to. And as part of the request for expenditure limitation, there's some criteria there. Number one, that they would have to meet. Number one would be present a set of performance measures both for the construction phase as well as the ongoing project to the satisfaction of, in this case, the emergency board and its members. A description of all efforts to seek local participation in the project, specifically in the regions they're wanting to propose for development. And prior to that, that the project, the Owen project, would present a set of local partnership standards to at least the Owen work group if it continues. Also present a description and updated cost estimates and timetable for the project, and finally an estimate of the ongoing operation and maintenance costs, including what could be seen in the long run as the local share of partner agency contributions to those ongoing costs. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is sort of a summary of the work group discussion around this issue, as well as a proposal to put on the table that LFO is at this time recommending to include into the bonding bill.
Okay. Any comments, Mr. Ball, or should I just, I know you're here and mostly available for questions, but if there were a minute or two of introductory comments, you're welcome to that, or you don't have to.
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I work in the governor's office assigned to the Owen project, and I feel that Mr. Wilson has done an excellent job in giving everyone a brief of what's taken place the last 2.5+ months.
Thank you. Discussion from committee members. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I couldn't be more supportive of the concept. Back when I was a working pilot, showing up at a fire and not having people be able to talk to each other to me was just inconceivable. So I'm a big supporter of the concept, and I'm a big supporter of Mr. Ball and his demonstrated ability to deliver on projects. I've heard from home about how supportive they are, but just listening, reading the report that came from LFO, it just continues to raise questions. Not being part of the work group, there may be material that the work group has that the rest of us don't have, which would be very instructive. But a couple of things quickly jump to mind. I have yet to see a plan for the construction. You talk about the urgency of using these federal funds that might be available in some southwest counties in the next 18 months. It's only 14 months until April of 09 when a construction season could start. I don't know why the urgency absent a construction plan. And I don't know what we're leaving on the table. I don't know what agreements you've made with whom in order to have a certain number of towers built in a certain number of places between now and 09. Forestry was in, and I know that forestry was recalcitrant about giving up their old system, and now all of a sudden we're not talking about forestry anymore. They've been dropped. I just am curious and would welcome additional education from the folks that have been sitting at the table for the last 2 months to try to understand where we are in the process. Are deals made, or will counties not make deals absent some commitment from the state? Do you have to have money in hand to incentivize local folks to make a deal with you? And I would welcome seeing the additional data that the work group has that maybe lays out where agreements have been made. The last time that I was closely involved in this, we met in the governor's office with the idea to try to price the whole system based on a handful of counties in northwest Oregon. Now I listen to Mr. Wilson talk about responding to emergencies wherever they crop up in the state. And I'm just kind of lost in a great big giant project that seems to be moving very, very quickly with a laudable goal, but the details are completely missing. And if the work group is satisfied that the details have been adequately addressed, then maybe we should just suck it up and rely on the work group. But from my perspective, I don't have any details at all.
Senator Schrader, as chair of the work group?
I'll volunteer to give it a try, and then I think Lindsay could fill in maybe more specific details. I think Senator Johnson reflects the deep concern that led us to this point, you know, especially on the Senate side, and I think on the House side also. You know, show me the meat. Where's the beef? And that has been a concern. The original project, as conceived and presented to us, was, well, let's figure out what this whole thing's going to cost and then parse it down and figure out what's the best bang for the buck, how much coverage area we have, this, that, and the other thing. It's going to cost us $665, $500, $400, $300, pick a number. The work group has gone a different direction. Because it has become apparent to us, it was apparent to us at our first, and the work group members can correct me if I'm missing anything, please. But it became apparent to us when we sat down the first time with Lindsay and a really excellent staff, I might say, that they actually gave us the answers that we had asked for as a body during session. They really went into some pretty good detail about what this Northwest experience could or could not save us in terms of money and dollars. And the takeaway I came away from that, and I think with some of the members, was several-fold, that there are opportunities there, but that to build out a system at this point in time with so many unknowns, as Senator Johnson has talked to us about, and guaranteed bonding authority for $600 million or $400, $500 million would be inappropriate. We don't have that. It also became very clear to us that we have some infrastructure that's just falling apart. You know, and the locals, and their testimony recently indicated their stuff's falling apart. We have to do some infrastructure. That became very apparent. So what's a thoughtful way to go about it? The other pieces of information, some of the details that you're alluding to, and we didn't get an excruciating detail. That's why we're not giving them the money right now. But there are two great partnerships that look like they're ready to go. One is in the northwest area, in the metro area, where they're very, frankly, far ahead of the state. They've got some money, so they're ready to move forward. They're very interested in what we're doing so that they don't do something duplicative of what we want, so we leverage the monies. But as you pointed out, no one's been moving until we started talking. What has happened is since our meeting in the governor's office saying, let's do the study, all of a sudden all these local people have popped up out of the woodwork. I mean, in a positive way, where all of a sudden they're saying, well, it looks like the state is serious. And Lindsay and his folks have been inundated, if you will, with requests for partnering. So I think I'm convinced, at least, and I think most of the group is, that, okay, there might be something we could really do in the metro area at this point in time in the northwest counties. The other thing that came up is there's this federal grant, $9 million for the southwest counties, that, you know, goes away in a prescribed time period. They were going to do a project along the I-5 corridor. Well, we're doing IWIN along the I-5 corridor, so that's kind of a waste of that money to do that. They would like to connect in a loop fashion, however, the rest of the counties, do that redundant loop that we've talked about to make sure the system actually operates in the case of a failure, i.e. on your coast. So it became an opportunity for us to partner with this money and see, can we leverage that and get the bigger bang for the buck? Again, there are the real small details, exactly how that plays out, we're going to have to see from them before we allocate any of the debt service or any of the limitation for the bonding authority. Now, the Bend project, well, frankly, we have not seen. That's something that Lindsay has put forward, and I think he's wise to do so because he's concerned we have this looming deadline of 2013. And in his mind, with the research they've done, they feel this is a project that could be going. I would suggest to the body that it may not be the Bend Metro Loop. If the federal grant process from our delegation shows that we get federal dollars for another portion of this general system that we've identified, I think that would be a more prudent use of those dollars. So the real specifics will be forthcoming, and I would hope we would not give the money until we're very convinced about the different details of partnership and stuff that we have. So the main things I think that we needed to do that would be going on with this is we would be making a commitment to digital. We would be making a commitment to potentially a trunked system. We had some good testimony from some experts about why that is very important. That can get costly. The Biker Wave system seems to be the best, most cost-effective system. However, we have a lot of dark fiber, we were told 2 days ago, that quite frankly, while redundancy is great, let's get something in the ground to begin with to get from point A to point B first. And maybe that would mean we'd use some fiber first. So there are some key, and if we talk in the way I understood, if we talk in these terms out loud, the local people then get to see a path upon which they may want to target and transect us at some point in the future. Many have gone to analog. The forestry department chose analog before this discussion got going. I would assume that over time, that was like 10 years ago or whatever the time frame was when they started looking at that. So now they will have a trajectory at some point in time towards the digital also.
The forestry thing really bothers me. This was trotted out as four agencies. One of them didn't like it. One of them has a system that's going to become obsolete in a very short period of time. They balked, and we stand back and give them a pass. I mean, that's what it sounds like. If we're truly going to build a system that meets all the needs, I don't want to be sitting in this room 5 years from now with another $30 million bill to include forestry because forestry didn't want to play this time around. And I don't know the details, and perhaps I'm talking too casually about what their approach to being part of this is. But they were advertised to be part of it. And I want to be clear, I don't care geographically where we start. This presentation has a little feel of a box of mice somebody tipped over that we're just going to run wherever there's federal money or wherever there's a tower that needs fixing. And I think if sitting here as a part of a committee of the whole for the last couple of weeks has done anything, I think it's given us all a broad perspective of how superficially we know some of the details of these projects where we're being asked to cast votes that commit millions of dollars. And yes, it's a good idea, but based on a good idea alone, I'm not sure that we know a fraction of the details that we should know. Now, if it's necessary for you to come to the counties with money in your pocket to be treated as a serious partner, that I understand and that I'm sympathetic to. But I can't in good conscience say okie dokie to a $76,000 plan that basically what I know about, because there obviously have been some substantial shifts since the last meeting that I was involved in, is all I know about it is a four-page LFO report. That's it. And clearly from that meeting in the governor's office, the six of you that are now doing this have taken a substantial change in direction. And I'm just asking it as a courtesy to the rest of us that are going to be asked to make a vote, bring us along on the information in a more substantive way than passing Lindsay in the hallway and saying your sheriff loves it. That's my
question. Mr. Lindsay, Mr. Ball, could you answer the question about the Department of Forestry?
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, the issue with forestry was that the work group felt that state police and ODOT was very important to get those systems up and in operation. Now, forestry has moved from wideband to narrowband analog system 3 years ago,
And as a result of that, they're discovering that their system is not providing the coverage that it once was. And they would probably have to put in some more repeaters in order to continue the same coverage. But it has been moved from a wide band to a narrow band and is probably the newest part of the communication system in the state.
Senator Johnson, I think you've raised some good questions. It is a challenge in work of a committee of the whole without truly substantive subcommittees that we essentially trust our colleagues to dig through the details, but it points out a very significant challenge in the way we do business.
May I conclude with two comments?
Please.
The first one is I'm not satisfied with the forestry answer at all, and I would like to know a better reason than why forestry was initially included in this and isn't, and I don't want to come back and have to do this again for forestry. If we're going to do this once, we ought to lay down a platform that everybody can use, and somebody, whether it's the governor or somebody, ought to have a serious chat with forestry and figure out so we're not in here fixing that later. And secondly, despite the fact that I look like I need a rabies shot, I am supportive of moving ahead with some kind of enhanced communication. I also want to make absolutely sure that our local partners know what they're buying or buying into. Having just come out of a flood where people literally couldn't talk to each other for 3 and in some cases 4 days, I think there's an expectation at the local level, at least in the folks that I talk to, that Owen is going to magically drop this blanket of communication over public safety providers, and the second they click on a radio, they can talk to everybody. And Mr. Ball and I have talked about this at some length to make sure that when they sign up for OWIN, they know precisely what the opportunities are and what the limitations are. And so I guess I'm just asking for more data as we move forward, but I don't want anybody who has listened to this tirade to come away with the impression that I'm an intransigent no. I just would like to know more before I commit a vote to a project of this magnitude.
Excellent points. Senator Verger.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I can understand Senator Johnson's frustration because I think that when this project first came, it came actually looking at statewide. It came with a big price tag. It came with a lot of pushback, and I was certainly one of those that pushed back very hard. I think what the work group has tried to do is slow down and erase the board and kind of start over. And the meeting in the governor's office that Senator Johnson referred to, they decided to pick a part of the state to have this pilot project. I was very disappointed in the part of the state that they picked, mainly because I felt like there were other parts of coastal communities that would be faced with more emergency areas such as tsunamis and were more open to disasters than that particular part. But having said that, I decided, and I talked to Senator Johnson about it, and I said, that's fine. That decision has been made, and I'll be happy with that. Then, this $9 million that was part of the transportation package, which Congressman DeFazio helped, Southwest counties, which is Lynn, Benton, Lane, Douglas, Coos, Curry, and Josephine. Now, they have these months to put something in place. They can put their own microwave system in place, which in their mind doesn't make a great deal of sense if the state is going to do something. If the state's going to do something, then they would rather partner with the state and get a lot more for that effort. Also, the Northwest section would be connected to the Southwest section. I am not ready to just say we ought to just carte blanche, just start throwing money. But I do believe, and actually the flood conditions up in Senator Johnson's area convinced me, we have just got to have a better communication system in Oregon. I just want to be sure that the system we have at the time that we need it
doesn't go down, and we're calling ham operators to come in. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to be reassured is that this truck system, this backbone, these microwaves, these connections between mountains later on down the road, is really going to work. I do believe, I don't think we should run just where there's federal money, but I do believe we should be certainly frugal and in looking at a way that we can get a system. I'm not sure that we can't put off the Bend-Medford loop for now. It certainly would be a part of the plan. And I'm very open to more answers, to more questions. The forestry thing has come up in the work group. One thing that I don't like about the system that they have, and certainly not for state police, is that it's not as secure. So I think we need a very secure system, and we need to be careful when we're having our tracks where we go in that we're not open to the very people that are trying to harm us if it should be a human disaster of some kind. But I am certainly supportive of trying to do as much as we can to begin and move forward slowly. And I appreciate very much, and I do want to say this, Madam Co-Chair, that Mr. Wilson really did a great job of capturing what the work group has done, as did Senator Schrader. That's exactly what we've done, and that's what we've talked about. I just feel like that if there are any questions, I think that they deserve answers. Yeah. If there's anything at all that needs to be said, but I think we need to really realize that we could face a very serious, far more even than we've already seen in the northern corner of the state. So,
thank you, Senator. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, in item 2 on page 4, you show that ODOT has $75 million set aside for Owen funding. Owen-related costs over time. What is that time period?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I'm not sure, but I think I'd have to go back and check on the actual time frame. But I think their thought was, and that was what was proposed in the governor's budget last time, that those funds would pay a share of the debt service costs over time. So it's $75 million is not available right now. It's over time to pay for debt service, most likely.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative.
So, Doug, if that $75 million is available over time as their share, and I'm glad you brought that point up, what roughly, if you know, would be ODOT's share of this entire package as a percentage?
Madam Chair, it's very hard to say because the state, what's contemplated, and Mr. Ball, chime in if you want, is that the state police and the DOT share a system along with other agencies, such as, even if forestry has their separate system now, the investments you're making today for state police and DOT also help them in the long run. They can join in and use some of the tower sites and the microwave system and the other things, as I understand it. But it's hard to sort of separate ODOT and state police because we're building a single system for two agencies. I don't know if you want to count on number of users or whatever it might be.
That's fine. Thank you. Can I follow up? Okay. My point here, folks, is that the amount of money that we're being asked to set aside currently for the program or to make available under COP is the $76 million. The biennium cost of that, financing that debt, as Doug has pointed out in item 4, is about $12.8 million per biennium. Just go with the idea with me, if you will, that maybe the state police and ODOT part of the deal is 50 or 75% of the entire project. And I don't know, so I'm guessing because we didn't come up with a number, but if we're saying they are the top two priority items, which I think I heard Mr. Ball say that the state police and ODOT are the priority for the project, the ODOT money alone for a number of biennia, which it would take to even
complete this first part, maybe it takes the first two biennia moving forward, the ODOT money could fund that piece of the project. I don't sit on the committee, but I did have an opportunity to sit down with Mr. Ball and review the project. Senator Johnson, I love your analogy of chasing mice out of a box, but after I sat down and looked at this project in terms of why is it we're going to local, to the counties, to municipalities, and chasing mice, we're doing that because there's opportunities presenting themselves within the system to both create the new microwave piece and the redundancy that I think we're looking for, i.e., as Senator Schrader mentioned, there might be a current link available that we are in the ground. We might be going from a tower to the ground and somewhere via cable and or glass lines. Other places where we're doing new projects, i.e. where the county has come on board and said, we have an opportunity for a new tower, we're using a microwave link. That redundancy within the system would have created a possibility on the coast or the coastal mountains whereby when landslides took out the landline portion, you had a microwave link. I see Representative Nathanson has a map. I don't think that's the most current map that I've seen that creates some of the inter-county links even in the southwestern counties that are being discussed. But what I saw was at least a plan for getting there and an engagement with municipalities and with counties to say, here's how we would link together with this system. Okay. I don't think Mr. Ball could answer the question, will that happen on this date and this date and this date, if I ask the question right now, and I won't, and I didn't then. But what I did see was some planning that made me think we are making progress on this beyond where I had seen before, because I was a major skeptic of the total cost of this program, and I had not seen the work being done by anybody involved in the program prior to this that was engaging the other folks that we need to get on board. I agree that the forestry thing, somebody ought to take somebody to the woodshed, get that one figured out. But the idea that we are engaging all these others because we're putting it out there now is important. Senator Verger, to your point about the Southern Oregon Loop, the only thing I would stress about that particular piece is the state police dispatching comes out of Southern Oregon for Southern Oregon, and I think it's critical that we continue to have those kind of folks available and ready to go, you know. And so that Southern Oregon link would be critical on that piece. So
that means your time's up.
Yeah.
I have three more people in the queue, and then I think we're going to complete the conversation, although I would assume, Mr. Ball, that you are available for detailed follow-up with any member who wants either individual briefings or who would like to sit down with you a few members at a time.
And Chair Nolan, if I may, I would like to have a few closing comments.
Okay. I've got Representative Nathanson, then I also have Senator Bates and Senator Nelson, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to be stepping back for a minute here with, I guess, what's called the 30,000-foot view, and how did we get here and what's going on, not having been here in a previous session and knowing the history and the bad vibes and the suspicions, what is this, just stepping into it last year, where I think we were and where we are now. One of the things I want to start with is this is about high-tech stuff, you know, broadband versus narrowband. It's about software, digital versus analog, but it's also about just on-the-ground things, towers, dishes, cables, power, backup power supplies. The $665 million figure, I think, was just a mistake from the beginning, because the initial impression, I believe, was the state's cost would be $665 million. In the way I review this and understand it, the state never would have been spending $665 million. The state would have entered into partnerships with local governments, with federal agencies, $665 may have represented the value of all the different kind of systems and equipment that would have been brought together to have a fully interoperable system for the state. But out of that $665, many tens of millions of dollars of investment already existed. Many millions of dollars of federal grants were going to be on the way and will come in the future. Many millions of dollars of county and even city projects have been completed or will be completed. So the state's share never was, we need to write a check for $665 million. It was always something less than that. It wasn't part of the story that came out. That's the way I'm trying to look at this. How do you put all the value of everybody's projects together to make a whole system? And I know that's not the common understanding necessarily even from staff, how you figure out the value of all these things and the state's part and the local part. But what this work group has done has said, if we don't have all of that money, what do we do? For me, it was very important to remember, this is about the big one, the big event that may happen. It's about the occasional disasters, such as the horrible disaster that happened in the northwest part of the state in 2007. It's also about all those daily things. When the cops and the firefighters have the emergencies moving from one jurisdiction to another, you move from one volunteer fire district to another, when the fire's jumping around in Central Oregon or Southern Oregon, and they can't even talk to each other. They can't get data or a map or even a simple voice communication. The wind just shifted. Get out of there or you need to move to here now. When shots are fired and then there's a chase from one jurisdiction to another, how do you communicate together right now? People literally have two or three different kinds of radios sitting on a car seat. And which radio do you pick up and what do you do? And if you don't have a radio for the county that you're traveling into, well, you're out of luck. And so are the people who we're trying to protect. That's what it's about. So when we've been looking at this over these months, it's been important to me to still focus on what is it we get. We're trying to improve safety for Oregonians every day as well as for the big events. And it's going to require interoperability for state agencies and local agencies. How can we do a project? How can we spend our money in a way that collaborates with the local governments who are also spending money so that we each, or all of us, get more than what we could have individually? So rather than 1 plus 1 equals 2, we might have 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, but get a huge benefit for the state and for everyone. When we heard from local governments, counties in particular, but also from cities a week ago, that was like a watershed event for me, because what we heard there in that meeting says to me, we need to move now. There was a great sense of urgency. We need to move now, and they're ready to collaborate. We need to collaborate to be able to afford what we think we need to do. I'm going to read to you quickly four quotes from these representatives of counties and cities last week. There are too many cooks in the kitchen. They want state leadership. Number two, take advantage of partnerships at every opportunity. Three, the stars have aligned now. And four, this is a golden opportunity since we're already having to upgrade and improve local systems. Those are quotes from the local governments. They're ready. We're ready. And I think we better move on this while we can leverage local and federal money, or else not only do we lose what we needed to do as a state, but we lose for all of our counties and cities also. So that's why I want us to be moving forward in a way that you might view it now as a phased approach. Instead of asking for approval for a $665 million or $400 million project, as Senator Schrader said earlier, pick a number, instead of authority for one entire project, which is very complicated to figure out, I think it's a smart thing to do to start issuing authorization to move forward with pieces that make sense, that get us something now, that is absolutely an investment that will last for decades. Figure out what's valuable now and everyone can continue to make use of in phases. And I think that's the major shift that this work group has shown. We, in working with the staff and local governments, I think we can do this in a phased approach and start now.
Thank you, Representative.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll be brief because Representative Hannah and Representative Nathanson have covered a lot of what I was going to give you as experience we've had in Medford. Medford, we've actually completed the tower now, and it was a joint effort between the county and the state and federal government funds. I think the cost of the state was about 10% to 15% of the project. The rest of it was covered primarily by federal funds and a small amount by the county, too. And I may be wrong on those exact figures, but close. Some things we learned in that were, one, there was poor oversight at the actual building of the tower, and that needs to be tightened up. The discussion did occur, and there were reassurances that would happen in the future. Secondly, there was questions about, raised there, primarily by me, I suppose, about what's happening in the rest of the state, how are we tying into the rest of the state, and there was kind of a throwing up of hands. No one seemed to know at that time. It was about 3 or 4 months ago, but they were going to be working on that. It shows it can be done. It can be done in a reasonable fashion. The tower will be shared by both federal agencies, county agencies, and state police. There were concerns about who will be tied into the system. There was no reassurance that the Moses Department and the National Guard would be tied in, whether the Forest Service would be tied in. And as the experience we just had in Northwest Oregon, the agencies that came to the rescue there were a mixture of agencies, ODOT working with the military, and unfortunately calling in ham operators sometimes to get the job finally finished and done. So there's a real need out there. There is some hope from the Medford experience that it can be done. It can be done in a cost-effective way, but a lot of tightening up has to be done. So I've asked Mr. Ball in his closing arguments here, so to speak, to give us some insight about how other agencies in the state have been brought into, specifically the National Guard, some idea of what the cost of state might be, what's happening as far as statewide planning. And for Senator Schrader, I'd like to know if that work group will continue to meet and oversee this project. I hope they will. I haven't heard that, but I hope they will, because I think continuing legislative oversight, and this is going to be extremely important. I don't think the changes that have occurred in the program to bring state costs down and to bring some reasonableness to this program would have happened if the legislature hadn't stepped in. So a question for you, Senator Strayer, and Mr. Ball, in your closing discussion, you can possibly cover those points for us. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I mean, we ought to pat ourselves on the back because I think we've asked all the hard questions and made a huge progress. I think the legislature did their job in this case, and we're coming down with a good project. It's a very complex project. We've slowed it down. We're looking at building partnerships. I think Lindsay will talk about building partnerships. One of the things I heard today was OPB may be building or refurbishing 50 of their towers. Well, Lindsay's been talking with OPB. So how's that going to work into all this? And I think we're making some huge progress with this. And you have to remember, we're under a federal mandate to get this done, too. I mean, we don't have an option probably not to do anything. We have to do something. And so I think we have done the right thing to get to where we're supposed to be. Lincoln County just did a pilot project on their interoperability, and I think you'll find that's very successful. But they had to include healthcare institutions, schools, much broader. And I think that's the thing that we're really developing here, is we're developing a whole a spectrum. We're developing a group of people that are coming together in the partnerships. And I think the next step is we have to look at private industry. What can they offer to us in this thing? And I think Lindsay, in one of his statements to the group, said that's one of his sole things, or one of the things he's focused on now, is let's get private industry involved in this in some way and see what their resources are. And there's some issues that they have to work out from government and private industry, who has control and who's doing those things, but those things are being worked at. So, you know, I've asked our Republican caucus on the Senate side to invite Lindsay in and say, explained to us. And so maybe that's a suggestion that maybe some of the other caucuses would like to do, and so that he doesn't have to go around to 90 legislators and say, you know, things are really good here. And so
that's my point. Representative Shields has less than 1 minute, and then Lindsey Ball, who's been asked to answer all kinds of things in his closing comments, has 2 minutes. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Riley and Representative Nathanson for their work on this committee, even during the last legislative session when I asked them to represent the Public Safety Subcommittee in that work. But I also wanted to call attention to the fact that the auction of the 700 megahertz spectrum is really driving us towards that, the 2013 deadline, and the federal government is expected to have a windfall of about $10 to $15 billion from that. And that's going to be very nice take for the U.S. Treasury. So in case anyone knows anyone who might be looking to be in Congress one day, I would just recommend that they share in some of that bounty down the road.
Shameless.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, Mr. Ball. Closing comments.
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, I do want to reinforce what Representative Shields mentioned. The driving force behind this is the demand for bandwidth in communications today, wireless communications. Technology has allowed the Federal Communications Commission to now consolidate and sell bandwidth so we can all use cell phones and things of that nature. So I don't think there's any turning back on this. I think it's going to happen. A couple comments to put people's mind at ease. I haven't forgotten the consolidation in House Bill 2101 from 2005 that requires the four agencies to consolidate. That includes forestry. I think what was brought forth with respect to OSP and ODOT was a proposal that we might consider. So please use that as a bearing point with respect to forestry. Ultimately, I think from efficiency, forestry needs to be included, because if not, they'll be building their own towers and we'll be building our towers, etc. That's just not efficient. Secondly, my philosophy on this is to first partner with local governments, city, county governments, federal governments where we can, so that we do not have to construct dueling towers, if you will, on hilltop. Second to that, the way I propose to save is to use existing staff on in state government. There are 42 radio techs, electrical engineers, etc. We have not all the talent we need, because we just don't have the sheer numbers of people, but we have talent in state government that can defray that cost. Now, I know people challenge the state from time to time on the expertise that we do have, but I would, to maybe give you a little bit of confidence, we have a gentleman in the audience today by the name of Don Fole, who is on the Owen staff, and he has worked in the radio business for many, many years. By business, I mean constructing systems similar to what you're looking at. And this last November, he's gained such notoriety for his expertise, he was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame of the United States, along with the likes of Walter Cronkite and Morgan O'Brien, who is the father of Nextel. So I think if we cash in on those opportunities, we can bring this cost down. Do we have partnerships that are coming forth? Yes. You folks, by saying let's start in the Northwest, started that snowball rolling down the hill. 2-3 weeks ago, we received a request from the Southwest seven counties to be a part of Owen. Today, I was contacted by Lincoln County, which was the county separating the Northwest 7 from the Southwest 7, and talking with Sheriff Dennis Dotson, he says, you've got to get over here and start talking to me, because I'm putting my budget together, and part of it is radio communications, and I don't want to be building something that you're going to come in behind me and build. And so what I'm seeing is a lot of enthusiasm for people to share and partner, and If we don't take advantage of it, then we won't be coordinated, and we will have local governments spending money, state governments spending money in inefficient way. Now, once we partner with the government constituencies that we have in the state, I then want to create the opportunity for private industry to take a look at how we may be able to apply private industry to the system so that we can create a potential funding mechanism or a sharing system where we use their site, they use our site. There again, once again, defraying the costs. We've really been at this for about 2.5 months. A lot of things have happened. I do not at this time want to put any money on the table to spend. I'm not to the point, as Mr. Wilson said earlier, with the confidence that we've got something to guarantee that you're going to get what you buy. We'll get there. Just give me a few more months. And I think we can have something that people can start to reasonably understand and have some confidence in. So with that, Chair Nolan, members of the committee, I would ask, entertain any other questions that you may have.
Oh, no, you won't. Senator Schrader.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Co-Chair, I appreciate the good work everyone's done here today, and I appreciate the questions. There's more work to do, but I think we're on a more sustainable path with good oversight. There was a recommendation by LFO that the work group or some work group continue to pursue the oversight from the legislative end. So I would move the LFO Owen recommendation into House Bill 5100, the February session bonding bill, using the principles outlined in the February 14, 2008 document that we have here before us.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Senator Schrader has moved the LFO recommendation be incorporated into House Bill 5100. Discussion on that motion?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Schrader, within that motion, will it include any discussion of how the debt service is handled, i.e., how much of the debt service that ODOT might be willing to take, given that they have some funding available?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very good point. Absolutely.
Good point to put that on the record. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
I would be happy to vote for this with the guarantee from Mr. Ball that we will collectively figure out some mechanism to keep all of us up to speed. I had the experience of Scenic with all sorts of questions, all sorts of reassurances offered about Scenic, and then we discovered at the last minute the Department of Education wouldn't play. Mm-hmm. And I just think we have to have a mechanism to keep all of us up to speed with a high-risk undertaking like this. And so if that's contemplated in Senator Schrader's motion, I'll support the motion.
Perfectly fair request. And Mr. Ball?
Chair Nolan, Senator Johnson, one of the things that I've done in the past as I've worked through these kinds of issues that I've been tasked to accomplish, a monthly update to a work group, a committee, can be accomplished with what's taking place in the agency and the progress that we've made. I don't have any problem doing that. I support that.
Great. I think that is a good idea. Thanks. Any objections?
Madam Kutcher? I'm not objecting as a question.
Oh, Representative.
At what point should we expect to see performance measures?
Senator Schrader, your motion.
Well, I will say this before any debt service is issued. No opportunity for debt service.
That's also good to have on the record.
Chair Nolan, Representative DeLizio, we have developed some performance measures with the own staff and budget management staff. What I want to do is sit down with Don Farr of Legislative Fiscal Office and Doug Wilson to go over those performance measures. And then at that time, I'd be happy to share them with everybody. But they're still a work in progress. But about half the work's been done. Don's a very capable individual, as Doug Wilson is, and I would like to have them take a look at him as well.
Thank you for bringing that up. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. Thank you. Colleagues, we still have one more item on the agenda. And I appreciate the patience, persistence of the members of the audience who are here for that last item. Informational meeting. I'll open an informational meeting on the Department of Higher Education for a discussion of how the legislature should engage in other big construction projects. This is actually germane to the conversation we just had about how we, as the legislature's budget committee, should engage in planning for, deliberating on, prioritizing construction projects in the university system and the community colleges. Thanks, Steve. So I appreciate that lively discussion. A lot of it will be germane to this one. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members.
Mr. Stallworts are still here, though.
We've just distributed a one-page sheet to you that we hope will be helpful as you go through this discussion. As you can see, if you read the first sentence here, we talk about, we mentioned that the co-chairs are interested in improving the process that the legislature uses to evaluate capital construction projects at both higher education and community colleges. I need to add, though, that this is just an LFO document, and the co-chairs haven't improved everything on this page, but we're just hoping that this is something that will help you understand the kind of issues that are out there. So again, the goal is that the co-chairs wish to improve the legislature's ability to evaluate and prioritize capital construction projects requested by the Oregon University System and by community colleges, and to develop both short-term and longer-term capital construction financing plans for these facilities. There are a number of issues out there that are helping to lead to this request by the co-chairs, and I know it's very late and I don't know how much time you want to spend looking at any of these particular issues, but I have tried to list some issues and concerns relating to capital construction projects and post-secondary education and areas where there may be an interest in improving the legislature's handling of these issues. Some of these include evaluating what the needs are. There are many broad categories of capital construction requests that come to you each session. There are needs, there are requests for new facilities, for modernizing existing facilities, and to address deferred maintenance backlogs, which is basically to say those situations where buildings have gone into disrepair and need to be repaired. There is interest in determining a better method for determining the performance outcomes of proposed capital construction projects. So what we really can expect the institutions to be able to achieve if these capital projects are approved compared to what they would be able to achieve without them. There are issues, of course, of what can the state afford? How much can we afford to assist higher education, OUS, and community colleges meet these capital construction needs? These include issues of what our state bond capacity is and other affordability issues. How much general fund do we have and lottery funds to support these projects, given the other types of the many other demands on these revenue sources as well? There are issues relating to donations and gifts in capital construction projects. The state is very lucky to have donors that are willing to assist in constructing these projects, but there are times when these can cause problems. In a number of, not problems per se, but in a number of cases, donors have provided funding for particular projects and requested that the state match these in order for them to be constructed, and it is not necessarily the case that the legislature has reviewed and determined these are the top priorities from your point of view as to what project should be. Again, I won't go into detail with these other bullets, but just the different sources of funding, how they should be used, the There are some specific questions relating to community colleges compared to higher ed. There are some differences between the two, and I think part of this was recognized in the fact that there had been a long hiatus when the state did not provide any support to community colleges, capital construction projects, and that decision was changed in 2005. And since then, the state has been providing bond support for these projects. But again, this is a new, relatively new process, getting back into this support, and there are specific questions. And finally, there are questions of how, when you develop criteria, under what conditions should these be changed?
Mm-hmm. What would change the criteria?
What we recommend here is that there be established a working group of legislative members and OUS and community college representatives that will meet periodically beginning after, sometime after this session, supplemental session concludes, to address these issues and make recommendations. The term OUS and community college representatives is fairly vague, but persons, for example, from these would be both administrators centrally and at the colleges and universities, as well as members of the boards of higher education and education who are responsible for forwarding requests for capital projects to you. So that's just the general outline. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Senator Schrader, if you'd like to frame this up?
That's all I'd like to do, if that's acceptable, Madam Chair. I mean, you guys are all from Ways and Means, and you understand probably already why we have this before us today. And over the 11 years I've been here, we see lots of great projects offered. It's always difficult for us to grasp why which one seems to be coming forward and not another one. Their donors are giving money, and is it really the right strategic direction for the state and for the university? You don't want to lose donors, though, all this sort of thing. So the goal here would be to help the university and community college system and develop some broad outlines of a criteria by which everyone gets to come up and share in our bonding authority under some sort of sustainable rubric. We're already, for instance, at our bonding limit for lottery bonds. We maxed out last session. We maxed out. Certainly we have more room under our general obligation, but the goal here is just to be a little more thoughtful so that instead of pitting each other against one another because it's our region, our school, et cetera, there'll be some systematic approach. And I'll go to the community colleges because, historically we hadn't done that. And originally, last session before last, it was to, ostensibly help some schools who really needed some help. They didn't have the wherewithal in their communities. They were not in the valley, if you will, from Portland, where there's a little more economic development and the assessment values are much higher. But then it evolved into, all the community colleges have ongoing needs, and we ended up by default developing a rough criteria, a certain bonding level ceiling, trying to make some sort of rotational system where all the community colleges would eventually have an opportunity to come forward and make their case for matching dollars from the state. My two cents would be, I think it's valuable to try and institutionalize something like that. So after we're gone from here, in whatever capacity, there'll at least have been some strategic, thoughtful way to go about this. In the higher education arena, Senator Deckert and others have indicated that there's some opportunity to learn from other states. California has a little more of a systematic approach. Politics always enters in. We're never going to get rid of that. But I think it's really important to lay out, for George and the rest of our partners in the university system, how do we actually prioritize projects given our economic needs over a 6 to 10 year period, given donor opportunities over that same period, and prioritize things, I think, for the good of the order. So that's the thought behind this, and I think it would hopefully make things a little more effective and make our job a lot easier when we walk in the door. But one thing I'd add is I would assume LFO and BAM would be staff to this committee, no offense, Steve, and help us, guide us in whatever direction the committee would want to do.
Okay. So what we wanted to do is get some discussion, feedback from you, things we haven't thought about here, good idea, bad idea, that kind of thing. Representative Morgan. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I really salute the co-chairs bringing this concept forward. I think that during the 10 years that I've been in the system, just watching the change that's taken place around the cost of the projects, the scope of the projects, the different funding mechanisms that have been brought forward that put the deals together, that there really is some need to, I think, have a discussion around this. I think that the system that the state has been working with is far too static to deal with the dynamic that's going on out there in the higher ed system and now in the community college system, and that the policy decision that was made to start doing capital construction within the community college system didn't really get thought through very well. It was kind of an 11th hour decision, and I think the ramifications of that in terms of the opportunities within the higher ed system haven't been clearly thought out. And I think that it is only fair, given that the state participation in these projects compared to the private financing that's going into them and some of the other things that are going into them, is not now always a big player in the financing arrangements. And so there's got to be some new ways to look at this, because I think that we actually impede progress in the higher ed system when it comes to capital construction projects. And I don't think it's in the best interest of the system for the state to play that role. I think that we need to be prudent, and we need to make sure that the arrangements are transparent and that they hold water financially. But I do support an opportunity to open up the dialogue and get some new information and some new ways of looking at this on the table.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I appreciate having this as a talking piece. I would like to believe that one of the reasons in 2005 that we did support capital construction for community colleges was the very disciplined way that the community colleges went about helping to select projects. And I don't see that nuance reflected here. The fact that the community college presidents locked themselves in the hermetically sealed room and worked among themselves, those that would know best what their needs were, and came forward to the legislature with their own prioritized list, I think gave great credence to the process. And it's something that I would like to have considered in this draft talking paper. It might be well that the whole OUS system do that, because right now it's somewhat of a beauty pageant, and it is somewhat the result of good lobbying rather than a thoughtful process. If we turn to the experts and ask them to come in with these disciplined lists, recognizing that there needs to be a turn for everybody somewhere on the continuum, I just want to capture that and applaud the fact that it happened, and I think that it was extremely useful for the legislature in making commitments in the last cycle.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Galizia. Senator Bates.
Yeah, just a couple comments. My first comment to Senator Schrader. He mentioned people leaving the building in various capacities. I hope that no one leaves here dead, but I think the message was that...
don't take care of them, Doc.
Yeah. Well, I pick my patients and I pick my victims. The message I got there was that we shouldn't be looking for federal funds for capital needs of our community colleges, I think. Is that true, Senator Schrader? Is that the message you're trying to give us?
No, sir. I get no inference whatsoever along any line.
On a more serious basis, I want to follow up on what Senator Johnson said. We probably shouldn't let us sit next to each other. We did have a good... a listing of capital projects by the community colleges last time, which was actually pretty helpful. But unfortunately, some of that got caught up in the political games you play in this building, and some of that was forgotten. I think you also have to go and look at the same time, if you're going to set up a group like this, how we're distributing the funds for community colleges and for the major universities, because some of that plays into our deferred maintenance issues. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a real problem with some community colleges, especially basically not getting their so-called fair share, and some community colleges in rural areas need more than their fair share to be viable. They just need that. They're not going to be able to make it out there in Pendleton and down the coast. I've gone to various campuses as an example and seen some that are just beautiful campuses. I don't need to take that away from them. You know, Hood River and some others have wonderful campuses. But I've also been down the coast and saw the buildings they have there, and they're really not appropriate. And so we have to put those kind of thoughts in our minds. The other issue we're dealing with is we're trying to make one university system. We're trying to tie the community colleges to the higher ed systems. And you may want to even consider putting together a priority list that combines both those lists, because our students are now transferring readily back and forth. We've set up a program where, well, programs where if you get accredited at a community college, it's automatically transferred to a higher ed. We need continuity there. And I'm tired of pitting higher ed against community colleges against each other, and all the politics get played in that game. So we're setting up a work group that can really work through those issues before it gets to us, I think, is a very wise choice. But those are some of the issues that I would widen this out to. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Felizio.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Of course, community colleges are higher education.
Just try to differentiate this. It wasn't a slam. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
I
didn't think it was evil intent or anything like that. Just want to make for the record. I don't know the extent to which we can really institutionalize criteria, but I think it's our responsibility to try to set clear criteria so that the institutions of higher ed have an understanding of what they're supposed to do as far in advance as possible. And I would like to nominate myself to be involved in the work group. So,
excellent. Good. Thank you. Senator Whitsett.
I think this is a great idea. I think that we should be looking at probably first and foremost the return to the taxpayers for the taxpayers' investment. Mm-hmm. Are we going to be building facilities and structures that will educate kids that, in areas that are needed in the state, that will promote economic development? Not that everything in education should be that esoteric, but I mean, I think we should be looking at things that will really help the economy of our state and will drive. I think that should be really be driving our decisions first and foremost.
Excellent point, and I'm sure that the work group could have a robust debate about various competing contributions to that, but I think that's where we ought to be doing it. Yes. We ought to be having exactly that debate.
Invite the comments.
Any other comments? You will hear from us then on this initiative expeditiously. I don't think we need a motion on that one just yet. Thank you for your attendance and your availability. We look forward to working with both the university system and the community colleges so that neither one of us is surprising each other. Thank you. Thanks. We're adjourned.